what triggered this book? It doesn't seem to have any kind of a logical anniversary date to it or anything like that. It's been 42 years since the assassination. What brought this book on?
It really comes down to Memphis. I grew up in Memphis. It's the biggest thing that ever happened in my hometown. And my father was an attorney who worked for the firm that represented the garbage workers that went on strike that brought King to Memphis. So I've long had an idea of going back to Memphis and trying to deconstruct this event, which was the first thing that really the first time I can remember history happening, you know, in terms of the glare of history bearing down on my hometown. And so I kind of wanted to go back and explore this thing and figure out, you know, why it happened in Memphis and what was going on. That's really what animated the project for the first year or so. But as I came to the conclusion that James Earl Ray really did it, I mean, I really did start with the idea that maybe he was part of this giant conspiracy, because that's what I'd always heard growing up in Memphis. But once I decided that he did do it, that the evidence was overwhelming against him, then I wanted to know, all right, who is this guy? Who is James Earl Ray? Why was he there? What do we know about his movements and his habits and his, you know, various identities and so forth? And that sent me on a goose chase that sent me around the world. And the story keeps circling back to Memphis, but it really becomes a much more international tale.
In fact, Memphis strikes me as being basically just one of the characters in the book.
Yeah, in a way it is. I mean, you know, it's a city with a very definite sense of itself, a very definite atmosphere. It's a city perched on the racial fault line. It's the capital of the Delta and of blues and of cotton. And it seemed rather extraordinary and somewhat scripted by fate that Martin Luther King would have been killed in this racially freighted place on the Mississippi River, you know, given all of his travels, all the places that he was in those last months, that he would be killed in Memphis is fairly profound. And it's sad, it's tragic, but it's also in some ways fitting.
You start the book with James Earl Ray's escape from the Missouri Penitentiary. Were you able to learn anything new about his escape that hadn't been pretty generally known about how he did it and how he got away that we hadn't known before?
Well, not really. I mean, I went there. I tried to get a feel of the atmosphere of it. I tried to put it together as a narrative as opposed to sort of a post-mortem analysis, which is what most of the books have done, is really trying to figure out, you know, what sort of accomplice he might have had or that sort of thing. But I don't think there's any great mystery to how he escaped, and he certainly talked about it in his various books and in his many hours of testimony. So there wasn't a whole lot, to do in terms of proving something new. It was just a question of putting the narrative together in a way that was it was interesting, because, you know, I do think it shows an important part of his character. We have this idea that James Earl Ray was this bumbling hillbilly, and some people think, well, that's proof right there that he couldn't have pulled this assassination off. But he escaped from a maximum security prison, not only one, but actually two maximum security prisons, because after the assassination, you know, he escaped from that one in Tennessee. And, you know, it shows his patience, his ability to plan and plot. And, you know, whenever he was in a prison, he was always thinking about how to get out. And that's a particular kind of person. Not all prisoners do that. Most of them give up and say, well, this is where I'm going to be, and I'm just going to serve my time. But he always was trying to figure a way out. It was really a big part of his personality.
I remember well when he escaped, because I was reporting on a local radio station here in Jefferson City at the time, and I remember that there were several days that went by, two or three it seems to me, where the people at the prison were not sure he was missing. He apparently had a record of some kind of pulling things in the prison and hiding out on them. And so that gave him some time to get out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what happened was they figured he was hiding somewhere within the walls of that vast compound, and he'd turn up sooner or later. It was a real hard place to break out of, and not many people had done it, and certainly none in institutional memory had done it successfully. they'd gotten out only to get recaptured. So, you know, I think that you're right. That bought him a little time. And I think he was a little bit disappointed. There's a couple of lines in his memoir where he talks about, and he was surprised that he wasn't pursued by, you know, by helicopters and planes and dogs, and, you know, that he wasn't on the FBI most wanted list. He was, you know, considered a medium level criminal, and there was a small reward posted, but you know, there wasn't the giant manhunt that I think he expected and kind of in a way wanted.
Well, he not only well planned the escape, but he planned the first week or so after he got out of what he was going to be doing, and he stayed in the general area of the prison for a while, I guess until things cooled off, and he had that planned pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, in his book, he talks about, now, there's always a little bit of a danger relying on his book and relying on his testimony, because he lied so much, quite honestly. He constantly changed his story. But he, in his book, says that he headed west towards Kansas City first to throw people off, because they knew, of course, the prison folks knew that that he had family back in St. Louis. And in fact, his brother, John Larry Ray, had visited him the day before the escape. No doubt they talked about it. In John Larry's book, which came out a few years ago, he said that he eventually did pick up Jimmy, as he called his brother, and, you know, was involved, I guess you'd say, directly involved in harboring him and getting him out of Missouri.
You don't touch on this very much in the book, as it's been a few days since I read that segment. You don't touch very much on James Earl Ray and how he developed as a human being, and where this strong feeling developed against black people. Where did that come from?
Well, you know, a lot of different sources, and it's hard to say exactly. There was certainly a good bit of racism in his family, and there was certainly, you know, he grew up in a part of southern Illinois that's sometimes referred to as Little Dixie. He talked about when he was in prison, talked about how killing Martin Lucifer Coon, as he called him, would really be his retirement plan. But where it comes from, I mean, where does any kind of hatred like that really come from? It's hard to say, other than that family was extremely poor and part of a, you know, I think there was a strain of racism through the South among poor whites who kind of looked down on blacks in a sort of socioeconomic pecking order. And this is something that Wallace tapped into very successfully in his 1968 campaign for president. It just sort of the disenfranchised lower class whites who felt like history was turning against them, and then black folks were getting the jobs that had, you know, had been earmarked for them, and you know, they didn't like the direction society was going in.
But here's a guy who is just basically a lower level hood who wound up in the Missouri penitentiary. You make a point in the book several times that he was the kind of a guy most people overlook. He was just
right.
An average-looking guy, and the description seems to be repeated time and time again. Average
yeah.
guy, average height, average face, even
right.
in prison.
Yeah, and that was intentional. I mean, yeah, he was sort of statistically in the middle, but he really tried hard to blend in. And he always said he wanted to have a face that no one could remember. And, you know, he averted his gaze, he kept his head down, he didn't look you in the eye, he didn't speak up, he mumbled, he kind of just blended in. And that's why when he left prison, people didn't really notice his absence for a while. And if he was in the room with you, people would often say, you know, you couldn't remember. You know, he just left the room, and you can't remember, what exactly did he look like? Very hard to describe, and that was certainly part of his M.O.
He was a con man in and out of prison, too, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, he was, and he was particularly good at developing aliases. He had some 39 different aliases in his criminal career. During the period that I write about, he's Eric Galt, he's Paul Bridgman, he's Harvey Lohmeyer, he's John Willard, He's Ramon Snead, and a couple of other names in there too. So, you know, he's con. Yeah, you say con artist or con man. He's certainly always trying to fool people, and I think this is part of what gets at the heart of his personality is this idea of wanting to baffle people around him. The psychologists call it the duping delight. This idea that, you know, it's like he just gets off on confusing people, sending out mixed signals, lying. And so anyone who had encounters with him, whether it was his own lawyers or cops or journalists or anyone, found themselves playing this cat-and-mouse game where they couldn't figure out what he was saying, what was his point, what was his story, what was his name even. And he loved it. He just thought it was great putting one over on people who were supposedly smarter than he was.
How did you decide, as you were reading through all of the stuff he wrote, the books and other manuscripts you had access to, how did you decide what segments were the most credible and what segments were so much of a lie you just wouldn't use them at all or consider
them?
Yeah,
well, you know, constant problem. And I'm, you know, constantly sifting this stuff. If there's something that can be independently verified, great. If it's a passage where, you know, it really doesn't. He seems to tell the truth when it doesn't have any probative value, you know, like in terms of his case. You know, why not tell the truth when he's talking about what he did in Los Angeles and some of his interests in, you know, extracurricular interests in hypnotism and so forth. Sometimes I would just have to say in the book that it was just simply what he said in his memoirs, and maybe flag it as something that could, in fact, be not true. Other times you just can't use it because it is patently a lie. But sometimes his lies are interesting. You know, he's lying for a reason, usually, and there's usually kind of a strategy behind it that you can sometimes get under. But, you know, it's exhausting. I tell you what, I wrote my previous book was about Kit Carson and his role in the American West, and he was illiterate. Well, I tell you, I'd much prefer to write a book about an illiterate than someone who is semi-literate but, you know, lying all the time. It's because it was a goose chase constantly trying to figure out, you know, what's going on.
Well, you mentioned he traveled a lot, and the book covers a lot of those bases where he was traveling. Who financed all of this? I mean, he bought a car. He had a Mustang for a while, and he traveled all over the place. Where did the money come from?
The FBI and the House Select Committee on Assassinations thought the money came from a bank robbery. Ray and his brothers were suspects in a robbery that happened in Alton, Illinois, a month after he escaped from prison that netted $30,000. In his memoirs, as we've discussed, questionable memoirs, but you know, he talks repeatedly about stick-ups and various smuggling schemes, fencing schemes, gun running, contraband. So, you know, I think that most of his money came from the exact same source that his money came from his entire life, which was he was pulling stick-ups. He was a criminal, and when he got to Toronto, he tried to rob a grocery store. When he got to London, he was so desperate for money that he did, in fact, rob a bank. And so I think that his money was primarily coming from this kind of low-life criminal activity. I leave a lot of doors ajar, though, because, you know, we don't know what he was doing every step of the way, and it's possible that he connected with a bounty or thought he was going to connect with a bounty. It's possible that his brothers helped him in some way in terms of funneling money to him. Maybe he had some other sources of income. I'm not going to say definitively he didn't because I have no evidence to the contrary, but I think primarily it came from low-life criminal activity. This was his stock and trade.
Although he talked in prison about killing Martin Luther King, was there a specific point where he made the decision, yes, I'm going to go buy a gun, and yes, I am going to track him down and kill him?
I think that moment came on March 18th, 1968, when Martin Luther King came to Los Angeles and gave a talk within a few miles of where he was living in L.A. The very next day, he put in a change of address form for Atlanta, Georgia, and he moved to Atlanta, Martin Luther King's hometown. He had no connection to Atlanta. He didn't know anyone there, but here he is moving there. He goes and stays in one of his typical flop houses, and, you know, talking about money, I mean, yes, he did do some things that cost some money, like he bought a car, and he took dancing lessons and graduated from a bartending school. But the other side of the ledger is he lived really cheaply. He lived in these god-awful flop houses, and he was a cheapskate. He knew how to, you know, live as cheaply as possible. But he checked into this flop house in Atlanta. He bought maps of the city. He started scoping out the place. He went and bought a high-powered rifle in Birmingham. He was in Selma the night that King was giving a talk. And then he moves on to Memphis the same day that King moves into Memphis. But by this point, he's clearly stalking him.
Did you have access to various law enforcement records that many other authors had not seen before? Did any information come out of those?
The main source of the book, especially the manhunt, is a collection called the B. Vincent Hughes Collection in Memphis. And this is the first time that an author's been able to use it. It's the definitive, it's the largest, I would say it's the preeminent collection on the King assassination. It's some 20,000 documents. FBI, House Select Committee stuff as well. But the best stuff is Memphis Police, Memphis Fire Department, also Scotland Yard, Royal Canadian Mounted Police. A lot of documents and photos and, you know, crime scene evidentiary stuff. It's all digitized and it's all in this one place. And it's an extraordinary collection. It doesn't, in my mind, shed any, I mean, there's no huge bombshell that I don't prove in anywhere in this book, something crazy like, you know, Hoover was actually there in Memphis, you know, when the assassination happened or something like that. It's more like the accumulation of tiny details, lots and lots of details about all these flop houses, what they looked like, what the scene of the crime looked like, that common bathroom where the shot came from. It's just hundreds and hundreds of little details that come out of these documents.
You seem to write with parallel stories going. You've got Ray at the same time. This is going on in Memphis. This is what Martin Luther King is doing. This is what J. Edgar Hoover is up to. How difficult was it to be writing these parallel stories and keep the stories in a way that the reader would not lose track of what was going on?
Yeah. Well, that's the trick of narrative history. It's really hard to do it, but it's much more interesting, I find, when you can have the multiple stories and leave one story behind, pick up another thread, knowing that these various threads are going to become intertwined. And it was hard. I mean, I spent a lot of time, I'd say, more time than any other aspect of this book was figuring out the structure, figuring out the architecture. It's a big puzzle, and it's a lot of fun, but it's also a lot of work putting it all together.
Martin Luther King is not a saint in your book. He's a historical figure, a human being.
Yeah, not a regular human being, but a human being. I mean, I think there's been, understandably so, a halo glow around King. Many of the biographies tend to be hagiographies, and I really wanted to try to make him a human being. I think that his accomplishments become even more significant when you remember that he was a human being, which means he had some flaws and insecurities and vulnerabilities, especially in those last few years. He was stressed out to the max. He was getting death threats all the time, and he was not sleeping well, and he smoking and drinking, and yes, he had mistresses in various places, and he was trying to figure out the next phase of the civil rights movement, all against the backdrop of the Vietnam War, having made a lot of enemies because of his vocal criticism of the war. So it was a very different Martin Luther King than the one that has become sort of enshrined in public memory from, well, probably 1963, 1964, those years. This is a very different and much more stressed out Martin Luther King.
I noticed that as I read the book. I was not aware of the stress level that he was under at the time. J. Edgar Hoover, we've known about J. Edgar Hoover not liking Martin Luther King at all and doing investigations to go out and get him. Did you discover anything new about Hoover's motivations or Hoover's feelings as you did your research here?
Well, I think the main thing that I learned about Hoover was not so much his feelings about King before the assassination, because I think that's been pretty well documented, and it is absolutely true that Hoover hated King and wanted to smear his movement and do what he could to ruin him and all that. I mean, all of that has come out is absolutely true. But I think what is less well known is how, although he was reluctant at first to get involved in this investigation, the King assassination, when he became engaged, when it became convinced, he became convinced that they had to pursue this, he pulled out all the stops. I mean, you know, I figured he would have dragged his feet. I figured he and his agents, who have done so much to ruin King, would have, not really wanted to find King's killer. But, in fact, quite the opposite. I think there's a level of desperation in those memos coming out of Washington. The FBI is feeling an enormous amount of institutional pressure and institutional pride on the line to solve this case. There's 150 riots in cities all over the country after the assassination. The Attorney General, Ramsey Clark, is pressuring him. LBJ is pressuring him. There's a lot of pressure on Hoover to find King's killer. And it ends up being, at the time, the largest manhunt in American history. It lasted 65 days and used up some 3,000 different agents, field agents around the country. They finally got their guy.
I remember after the assassination, we even had a riot here in Jefferson City.
In Jefferson City, is that right?
Yes. Yes, the students from Lincoln University, which is the historically black university here in town, marched on the newspaper, which had run a highly critical editorial of Martin Luther King just a couple of days before the assassination.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. And they caused quite a bit of disturbance there. And in fact, the city declared a curfew. It happened just before spring break, so most of the students headed out of town that evening anyway.
Yeah.
But it was quite a thing in Jefferson City. We didn't have the burning that a lot of the other bigger cities had, but it was still a rather violent revolt after Dr. King was assassinated.
Wow. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. What does your book do? You've mentioned this earlier. What does your book do to the people who are conspiracy theorists here? And what has been the reaction, if you've gotten any, from some of those folks?
Well, I would say that my impact on the conspiracy-minded folks is zero, absolutely zero. I don't think any book could change their points of view on the assassination. I honestly believe that if I found a photograph of James Earl Ray holding a gun in that flop house with King in the background, dead on the balcony, it still wouldn't do anything, you know, because they would say, well, you know, it's clearly photoshopped. No, you know, I think that there's something about conspiracy that is it's hardwired to this human psyche, and it's a part of human nature, and we'll always have conspiracies. And I don't presume that my book is going to change anyone's opinion in that regard. I think maybe people who are on the bubble, people who aren't sure one way or the other, people who didn't know anything about the King assassination will be, I think, convinced by the book. But, it's not a polemical book. It's not a book that argues one thing or another. You can sort of take it or leave it. It is a narrative about Ray's movements, almost none of which are disputed. You know, he himself didn't dispute all of these facts, the facts that he went to all these different places. He admitted that he bought the gun. He admitted that he bought the scope and the ammunition. He admitted that he was in that flop house and that he bought a pair of binoculars 1 hour before the assassination. And, you know, he admitted that was his car and that he left the scene 1 minute afterwards and went to Atlanta and ditched it and so forth. So, you know, his only defense was that this guy named Raul pulled the trigger. But no evidence of Raul. Not a shred of evidence that he ever existed. I think the book really focuses on what we know about Ray and really just just kind of lets the conspiracy stuff seep in. It can exist. It can coexist with this book because, you know, it's based on the movements of Ray that we actually know about.
What finally did him in? Was it the rifle that he left behind in Memphis? What finally resulted in his capture?
When he left the scene of the crime, he saw a police car, and he was holding in his arms a bundle that had a lot of stuff in it, including the rifle, and including a pair of undershorts. It's the little things that get you sometimes, and in this case, he had a pair of undershorts that had a laundry tag in them, stamped in the inseam, and it was a new technology called the ThermoSeal Tape Company that FBI agents tracked down in Syracuse, New York. And they said, no, you know, most of these machines have been sold to laundromats out in Los Angeles. So they went to every laundromat in California and Southern California, found the laundromat where Ray had been taking his clothes, and found out what his alias was there, Eric Galt, which led to an address, which led to a photograph, which really blew the case wide open. And that's eventually what sank him. He stayed in all these god-awful flop houses and hung out with all these unsavory characters, but he loved to have his clothes fastidiously laundered once a week. So that's really what caught him.
Well, did he change at all during the time he was in prison after he was finally caught? Was there any kind of an alteration in his behavior or anything, or did he just remain James Earl Ray?
He remained James Earl Ray. I mean, you know, it was all a big game. He never really came clean. He told this story about Raul, but that story changed repeatedly. He broke out of prison again and got another nice chase going for 3 days before he was caught again. I think he went to his grave with a lot of secrets. I think that he is chuckling now in a way because there are people talking about him and wondering and scratching their head, trying to figure him out. And that was a real source of pleasure to him, is that he ended up going to his grave really as a big question mark.
Is that his legacy, the question mark? I mean,
that's part of his legacy. I mean, I think, and in this sense, I really am a conspiracist, this sort of larger conspiracy idea that, you know, that the culture of hate that was alive and well in 1968 and is alive and well today, there was a climate that led someone like Ray, who was mixed up and a lost soul, but also somewhat ambitious, led him to believe that he could change history by buying a gun and taking aim. I think that in that sense, that is really his legacy, as someone, a kind of a question mark, a cipher, who misconstrued some of the signals out there and took some things literally that someone like George Wallace was saying, and took aim at history.
Well, did he change history, or how did he change history?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that, I guess you could argue that someone else might have killed King. Someone, you know, certainly there were death threats all over the place, but he's the one that did it, and I think history is drastically different not having King around. I mean, can you imagine having him still around today? I think that history would be extremely, well, I mean, yes, he changed history because this is a figure that is so much a part of the pantheon. He changed history in an ironically in another way, which is he created a martyr out of the guy that he was hoping to take out, and in that sense, King's stature only increased. It only expanded after the assassination.
But you write in your book that Dr. King was already facing militancy within the civil rights movement. Would he have been able to resist that, or would that have been lessened had he lived, do you think?
Hard to know. Hard to know. These are things that, you know, these are the imponderables, I guess, what would have happened if he had lived. I think that he would have been a positive force in the culture and would have done great things, and would actually, how old would he be now? 70 something, not even particularly old. He was 39 when he was killed, so it is a tragedy. I mean, it's a great tragedy that he was killed, and especially killed by such a kind of a nothing of a person.
Your book is doing well, and you're getting good reactions when you're going out among the public here, Furman?
Yeah, I mean, the reactions have been great by and large, except for, of course, the conspiracy folks who don't like it and who are threatened by anyone who doesn't believe that, the CIA was behind it, or the Mafia, or the Trilateral Commission, or whatever. But, other than that group, it's been very well received.